It's the NACOcast, coming to you, as always, from Canada's National Arts Centre in Ottawa. My name is Christopher Millard. For those many faithful listeners of CBC's Ideas, you know producer and host Paul Kennedy to be as entertaining as he is enlightening. And he was every bit of that in his pre-concert talk of September 24th at the National Arts Centre. His theme was Amadeus, fiction, art, and truth. I think you'll enjoy his debunking of the many myths of Mozart's life, and you just might learn something new about that transcendent musical genius. And so, from the Panorama Room in the National Arts Centre in Ottawa, Paul Kennedy.
Good evening, bonsoir. Je m'appelle Paul Kennedy. I'm Paul Kennedy. I'm the host of a national radio program that's been on air in Canada for a long time, called Ideas, and I'm not quite that old, but I've been host for 12 years, and first I guess I want to say how both happy I am to be here and how honored I feel to have received the invitation to come to the National Arts Centre to give this pre-concert chat. I'm calling it, someone asked me today if it was a lecture, and I said, I don't want to pitch it that high. This is more of a chat. I'm honored to do it because I have an interesting relationship, I would say, with the National Arts Centre. One, it is my National Arts Centre, as it is your National Arts Centre. I remember the first time I came to Ottawa as a wee lad. It seemed like the only thing here was the Parliament buildings. And I remember going to the National Gallery, which is not in the beautiful new building that I went to this afternoon, to hear an amazing performance. I don't know if any of you were there, but the quartet performance this afternoon in the chapel at the gallery was magnificent. And yeah, it's bad to talk about that thing after the fact. If you weren't there, it'll just make you feel jealous. But it was astounding. Anyway, so the gallery was one thing. I noticed when I went into the old National Gallery, I felt sort of like, too bad that Canada doesn't have a better National Gallery, and now it does. When I came here another time, when I was a high school president and all of the high school presidents in Ontario were meeting in Ottawa, this building was a hole in the ground. But it was a hole in the ground that was full of hopes and dreams, and I had many hopes and dreams for it myself. It was something that I thought in some ways encapsulated some of the things I believe about this country, and some of the things I hope we can maintain, a commitment to the arts, and a belief that we can find a showcase here, not just for Canadian talent, but for talent from around the world. And I, from my pretty superficial, I must admit, knowledge of what has happened here in the years since then, I think we've succeeded rather well. And I know that from having been here initially. I went to Queens and Kingston, so I would come up to Ottawa to see performances, and I loved doing it. Then officially, I suppose, my working connection with the building started with my first job. I was the editor of a magazine called Fugue, which this is the February 1979 edition. This is Leona Boyd on the front cover. and I did the profile of Leona Boyd. I'll make a very serious confession. If I go down the table of contents page, Paul Kennedy did the eclectic guitar of Leona Boyd. There was an interview done in here by someone named Douglas Ryan, the Fugue interview with Kurt Mazur. Well, I know Douglas Ryan very well. That was me. Turns out I actually wrote most of the magazine as well as editing it. So I needed the number of names. That was Kurt Mazur was here at that point with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. This is before New York. That's how historic. I found it just earlier this week that this building, which was a hole in the ground, as I said, when I first came here, probably in 1968, whatever, around in there, this building has been dedicated or declared to be a National Historic Site. So that shows you how old I am. I'm a National Historic something. Anyway, I did this interview with Kurt Mazur in this building, and I felt like it's a wonderful feeling I've had throughout my professional life, I suppose, that when I actually work somewhere, I feel like I belong in that place in a completely different way. And I think that about cities. I remember the first time I worked in New York, I was a New Yorker. The first time I worked in London, I was a Londoner. And that's been true in all kinds of places. In some ways, I felt the first time I worked in this building, I became an artist or something, part of the National Arts Center. And it caused a feeling of great pride. That was the first time I worked here. The time after that I worked here was in 1993. I was the host on CBC Radio 2 of the CBC Young Performers Competition, which was broadcast all week long live from the opera at the Arts Center. And that was the year that James Ennis was the winner. And it sounds like you were all here for that one. Where were you this afternoon? Okay, that's me in the Arts Center and why I'm really proud to be here. The ostensible reason for being here is that I'm to talk about the Serenade No. 10 for 13 Instruments by Mozart, which is featured in the program. It's featured in the program because it is one awesome piece of music. That's why it's in the program. But the excuse for putting it, or one of the rationales for putting it in the program this evening, is that it's a piece of music that features very prominently, in fact, could be considered to be the most important piece of music in a play that then became a movie written by Peter Schaeffer called Amadeus. And you're probably all familiar with that. And in the middle of that movie, we'll refer to the movie, Salieri is suddenly, he says, filled with such unfulfillable longing, it seemed to me that I was hearing the voice of God. And that prompts in Salieri an interesting reaction, because he's also instantly filled with incredible jealousy, with envy, with an understanding, and it's an understanding, it's a truly cruel kind of insight. Salieri, he was smart enough and talented enough to know that Mozart was many layers above him when it came to artistic talent. And that's cruel, because if you're not that smart, you might not even know that and it wouldn't bother you. Mozart is Mozart. Who cares? But he was just on that edge, just on that cusp, just talented enough, just brilliant enough, because Salieri's music is something that probably does deserve some kind of consideration. But he was so close that it was exceptionally painful. And if you've seen the movie or seen the play or read it, you'll then know that his motivation becomes vengeance. And this is borne out by a form of historical fact. This chat is entitled Fact, Fiction, and Truth, and I've got a page on each of them here. The rumor started going around almost immediately after Salieri died that he had poisoned Mozart. In fact, the rumor started before that. Mozart himself started the rumor. He was saying about 6 months before he died that he felt that he was being poisoned. And he told his wife that. Constanze heard that fairly frequently, and she reports it in various things that were written after the fact. It's interesting that most of these sources of information come from after the fact. But Mozart started the rumor that he was poisoned. The rumor spread further, and in fact, there's evidence that Salieri himself, very late in his life, when he was committed to an insane asylum, told his nurse that he had poisoned Mozart. Now, the movie's a little ambiguous. You don't actually see Salieri poisoning him in any way, but you do see Salieri, his vengeance, his jealousy, which is green. I mean, the envy, I understand why that color is often associated with that emotion. I mean, he becomes so intensely bothered by the fact that he's confronting what is, frankly, one of the greatest geniuses in the history of music. And he realizes his own inadequacies, his own inability to get there. So fact, fiction, and truth is the subject of the chat. It could also be called Who Killed Mozart? And that's something that intrigues me from a number of directions. I was trained as an historian, and so I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to trying to find out facts, especially facts from the past, and there are various places you can do that. I also, while I was researching this chat this evening, I was astounded, by the way. I don't know how many of you people knew that there's actually a scientific journal called Medical Problems of Performing Artists. A quarterly journal. And they've done a lot of articles about Mozart down through the years. Mozart is somebody who's fascinated these kind of sleuths, medical sleuths. They want to find out what went on because what killed Mozart? Was it a poisoning? Was it Salieri? In fact, an article I discovered in this journal tells me that they've done a sort of scientific survey. There have been at least 118 different explanations for Mozart's death. That's a little bit of overkill, but 118 different explanations. The most frequent of all of them, according to this article, is kidney failure, that he died of some kind of renal failure. Now, what fascinates me about this is that, plainly, doctors are, in some sense, very curious about music. And maybe, this is purely speculative on my part, there are a lot of doctors who are musicians. That's their hobby. They play violin, they play piano, and so they sort of lose the boundaries between both of their work lives and their hobby life, and they become interested in this kind of thing. Another anecdotal thing from Mozart's actual life is that the night before he died, he famously died at 1 a.m. on December 5th, something like 9 p.m. on December 4th, they sent for Dr. Clausett, who was the doctor who was going to come to attend to Mozart. Dr. Clausett was at the theater watching an opera, and he decided he was going to watch the opera end before he came to see Mozart. And again, medicine and music mixes in a very strange way. Poisoning? Well, I'm not sure it could be said that Salieri, we'll go into some of the facts on that too, but I'm not sure that Salieri is probably the top suspect. If we were a forensic team, detectives, police sergeants, and things like that, trying to figure out who killed Mozart, probably a more likely candidate would be a guy called Hoftemer, who was a Mason, and it was widely speculated the Masons were not happy with the magic flute, and that they might want to take some very serious action against the composer who was actually paid by them to produce that piece. The other thing is that it's widely also known that Mozart liked to fool around. And Hoftemel's wife, who was 5 months pregnant at the time, was found fairly badly beaten up the day after Mozart was buried. And that wasn't the only thing. The razor that had been used to cut her had been used by her husband to kill himself in the next room. So if we're looking for motives, who killed Mozart? Who poisoned Mozart? I would say that's a more likely candidate than Salieri. There's problems, though, with the facts here. There was no real autopsy. There was a sort of an autopsy, except that all of the anecdotal evidence, again, given us by Constanza and her sister and other people were there, who said Mozart had swollen up like the Pillsbury Doughboy or the Michelin Man. He was huge, and this often does happen with renal failure. He also smelled, and there's speculation that no one actually wanted to do an autopsy because they didn't want to get very close to the body. It was that gross. The other problem is there's no body. There's a lot of debate now about whether it was a pauper's grave that Mozart was sent to outside Vienna, because apparently Constanza did pay for a third-class funeral. So he got a pauper's grave, but it was probably not the pauper's funeral that we're all told that he had. He was, however, buried in sort of a mass grave. Now, 10 years later, the body was exhumed, or at least bodies were exhumed from this mass grave. And the gravedigger had said that he'd wrapped a chunk of wire around Mozart's neck just before he buried him so he could identify the body. And there's a skull from that body in Salzburg now, in the Mozarteum, And people say it's Mozart's skull. Problem. The doctor's report after the death said that Mozart had 7 teeth. Not many. He lost a lot of teeth. That skull has 11. And skulls don't normally grow teeth. Another problem there is, that would be great if we're trying to do a DNA analysis, we could find out if it was Mozart in some way. Well, Mozart had 2 kids, neither of them had kids. There's no way we could do a DNA analysis. So, you know, the skull's there. If we had something we could trace down through the generations, we could maybe find something else about it. But there were no grandchildren, therefore no DNA. The most recent article, and this one's not in the magazine Medical Problems of Performing Artists, this one actually comes from the Annals of Internal Medicine. There was a study done by an international body of scientists, doctors, and musicians in 2009, so this is fairly recent work. That study came to the conclusion that Mozart was killed by streptococcal infection leading to acute nephritic syndrome caused by post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. Kidney disease, again, is what they say. The most convincing article I've read, though, and this goes back to Mozart spreading the rumors about his own death, you know, telling people, I'm being poisoned, somebody's poisoning me. I think Mozart actually probably died of hypochondria because he was taking a substance called antimony, which is a poison. Taken, I guess, in homeopathic doses, it doesn't kill you, but he was not taking homeopathic doses. He apparently had several doctors who were giving him this stuff. And then once he did fall ill, it was another big part of the prescription that was given him by Dr. Clausett, who was at the theater the night that Mozart, night before he died. So I think it's quite possible that Mozart poisoned himself rather than being poisoned by Salieri or by the offended, the cuckolded husband, or by anyone else. Mozart probably did it himself. That's as close as I can get to fact, and I don't know if we can get any closer, given the fact that we don't have body, head, autopsy, or any kind of information like that. So it's going to be very difficult. There'll be a lot of speculation about it, and I want to talk about why that speculation happens, because I think it's very interesting that it does. But let's get on to fiction. I was amazed when I started reading around this topic during the summer to find out that there's been a fair bit of fiction about Mozart's death and Mozart and Salieri's relationship, and it goes back a long time. In fact, in 1831, which is only a few months after Salieri himself died, Pushkin wrote a play called Mozart and Salieri. And it's an amazing play. I would recommend any of you to go look for it. It's a verse play. It's in 2 acts. It's very, very short. I don't read Russian. I read 3 different English translations. And I thought they were all fascinating because, once again, they go back to the theme that I was talking about earlier, jealousy and a sort of artistic understanding. It's being able to be at a point where you know exactly how close you are, but also knowing you can't go any further, that you have reached your limit, and somebody else who, and this is, you know, frankly, it bugged Salieri a great deal, that Mozart often did act like the little boy, the caricature that we see in the movie. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence for the fact that something stunted his emotional growth. He loved scatological humor. He loved playing jokes on musicians, and he'd write all these amazing things in scores pointed specifically at certain people. I mean, he was pretty silly sometimes, apparently, in public, and had no qualms about being so. And that's what sort of Pushkin is trying to get at in this play, where Salieri, it's very like, in fact, and I'm not saying, but I'm just saying, it's very like the relationship that Peter Schaeffer develops in Amadeus 150 years later. And I found an interview with Schaeffer, actually, in which he said that, oh, I never read The Little Tragedy by Pushkin until 20 years after I wrote Amadeus. Well, there's some lines, and I said, I told you I only read it in English translation. There's some lines that are very familiar sounding. I would say that if he didn't actually borrow from the Pushkin, and I'm not really trying to say that's a bad or a good thing. What's the cliche about artists? That great artists borrow and bad artists plagiarize. And you know, I think Schaefer probably did a fair bit of borrowing. But it is a great theme, and this is what I want to push a little farther in this talk too. It is such a great theme that it is a universal theme, and it becomes then not so much fiction as truth. And we'll get there in a moment. But that Pushkin play, which is in a group of four plays, I think, called Little Tragedies, is called Mozart and Salieri. That was the basis for the libretto of the Rimsky-Korsakov opera called Mozart and Salieri, which came out in 1898. And I would really recommend if any of you have internet access, go Google it, and you'll get into YouTube, and you'll see three different productions, one by Russian television, one by Bulgarian television, I believe, and I forget what the third one is, but they're lush productions. They're not unlike Amadeus in some ways, but they're television productions. They're in darkest Russian, so although one of them is subtitled, you can actually see what a different artist from a different century even did with the same topic. So we've got Pushkin, we've got Rimsky-Korsakov, then comes Peter Schaefer, and there's other treatments of it as well, but the Peter Schaefer's play was first produced in London in 1979. It was directed by Peter Hall, and it was completely rewritten for the New York production a couple years later. It was a runaway hit in London, runaway hit in New York, which meant that they, of course, had to make a movie of it. The movie came out in 1984, won 8 Oscars. Oscar for Best Film, F. Murray Abraham won the Best Actor that year, Best Costumes, Best Set Direction, Sound. It was luscious and beautiful. And so it did very well. I want to mention one more fictional representation of the myth before we move on to the truthful part. And this is another, I was going to suggest you go Google this too. I tried to do it this afternoon. I did it in the summer when I was researching this. There was a Simpsons episode called Margical History Tour. It's a great episode in which Marge is taking the kids to the library, and they get into the library and they find out there's no books. And so Marge proceeds to try to teach them about history, and one of them has to do something about Mozart, so she proceeds to tell them the story of Mozart. Now, this is the 11th episode of the 15th season of The Simpsons. It was broadcast first in 2004. I watched it in the summer when I was researching this on my laptop, and it was hilarious and wonderful and fabulous. This afternoon I tried to hit it from my hotel room here in Ottawa and was told that the video had been removed by the multinational corporation that owns The Simpsons. Unless it somehow gets back up there again, you won't be able to see it. But let me just tell you a little bit about it. Of course, Marge is telling this in the classic cartoon style. Bart becomes Mozart. Similar characters, from what I said, Mozart was, told a lot of sort of puerile scatological jokes, and Bart's not unlike that. Lisa, of course, is Salieri, because she works hard. This is a bug Salieri that he was the hardest working musician he knew. And Mozart just played around, but created unbelievable music, like the Serenade. The emperor in Austro-Hungary, in Vienna, was Mr. Burns, of course. What I loved was Nelson, who got to be Beethoven. Homer, of course, was Leopold. He's the father of Mozart. And Homer, again, like Leopold, is sort of saying, hey, this kid of mine is a pretty good financial bet for me. I'm lazy, but I can live off this kid. So he plays a lot like Leopold, sort of urging Mozart on for not always the right reasons. When I mentioned that Nelson plays Beethoven, what's really wonderful there is that at one point he laughs, and he goes, ha, 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 ha. There's musical jokes all the way through it. Bart at one point, the guys who create The Simpsons are plainly crazy, but there's musical references across, anachronistically all over across history. There's one that plainly they're referring to Jimi Hendrix, because Jimi Hendrix famously played guitar with his teeth once. So Bart plays the piano with his teeth, as Mozart. What he's composing in this Simpsons episode is a new opera, which is called The Musical Fruit, not unlike The Magic Flute. In fact, he sets, and things get mixed up metaphorically here, he sets the famous line that I certainly remember from my own premature or immature childhood, Beans, Beans, The Musical Fruit. That's set to the tune of Ina Klein and Knox music. So it's the kind of thing. But what again fascinates me is that whatever happened, whoever killed Mozart, people are still talking about it. I mean, The Simpsons in 2004 seems probably one of the most unlikely places that one would get a retelling of the story. The same story that only moments after it happened, Pushkin was writing about in Russia, a long, long way away from Vienna. So why does it have this sort of staying power? I think it's because it's not fiction, it's truth. And so we started with fact, which is not truth. I'm an historian and I know enough to know that historians are seeking truth but can never find it. What they find is facts. And then they can interpret those facts. But truth is a little harder than that to pin down. I think that the Mozart-Salieri story, and it's the story that, again, the music you'll be hearing tonight is the music that apparently set Salieri off on this jealous rage that might have, and lots of people have thought that he did kill Mozart, that he actually poisoned him, and he apparently told his nurse that he did. The fact is sort of not important anymore. What's important is the truth, and the jealousy theme, as it is discussed by Pushkin, or then Rimsky-Korsakov, ultimately by Peter Schaeffer, is a great literary theme. And in this particular telling, it's got that other element that I was talking about, and that is, it's not just jealousy, it's a kind of truly insane jealousy because of the pain this guy felt because he knew so much, but not enough. If he hadn't been as good a musician as he was, Salieri probably would have been able to live with this. He wouldn't have been as jealous, and it wouldn't have bothered him as much. But because he was right on that cusp, right on that edge, he probably more than anybody else in Vienna, Haydn, but anybody else in Vienna at that time understood that Mozart was pretty amazing. And that's what ate away at him and killed him. Now, who killed Mozart? Nobody. Mozart killed himself, if anything. Who killed Salieri? Maybe Mozart. Although Mozart was dead, but Salieri disappeared from the repertoire, and there was a long time when nobody played him. He wrote lots of operas, he wrote lots of music, and it sort of disappeared. Mozart liked his music. He writes letters to his father in which he talks very favorably about the Salieri music he's hearing in Vienna. Who killed Salieri? Maybe Mozart, I'd say, but if anything, Peter Schaeffer brought Salieri back to life, because Salieri's coming back. It's sneaking back into the repertoire. In 2003, Cecilia Bartoli released an album called the Salieri Album, 13 arias from operas by Salieri. In 2004, the Salieri opera, I forget the exact title, Europa something, I don't know the opera at all, but it was chosen to be the work that reopened La Scala after the renovations. So La Scala is a fairly important house, and to choose that piece of music to open it says something, I think, about the reemergence of Salieri. I don't think this would have happened if a play and then a movie called Amadeus had not existed. I think there was a lot of public attention suddenly brought to Salieri, and people like Cecilia Bartoli respond to it by releasing albums. So what am I saying? I'm saying that jealousy and envy, it's a universal theme. Othello, for example, is a play that's written on the same kind of a theme. There's a love connection there. But this is about art as well. This is jealousy emerging from art and what it does to poison first a relationship and then actually a character, an individual, in the form of Salieri. What else is interesting about all this stuff? Well, why are we interested in it? I asked that very near the beginning. Why are doctors interested in it? Why do medical journals like the one I talk about it all the time? I think that we have an almost abnormal interest in other people's deaths. And the death of artists is particularly interesting to us. And the death of artists at a young age, Keats would be the other famous example that I would use, seems somehow unbelievably poignant, but also fascinating. Why? Because I think we take an artist like Mozart, and we consider him to be immortal. Like I said, nobody killed Mozart. In fact, tonight you're going to hear a performance which will prove me right. Mozart's not dead, or there wouldn't be that many bums sitting in that many seats in the opera house tonight. He's very much alive, and will remain alive, I think. We like the fact, though, that the story of his death, which is so interesting, makes us understand he was also mortal, and makes us, I think, feel closer to Mozart in some strange way. I mean, I have no idea how he wrote the music that he wrote. It's not my field. I can go nowhere near it. I think he was... Mozart in music is what I think Leonardo da Vinci was in painting and what Shakespeare was in playwriting. I think I never was a great logician. I did do some philosophy in university, but I think that those three lives could be proven. It could prove that there have been Martians here before, because those folks weren't born on Earth. They have something that the rest of us just don't have. But when we look at their deaths, or specifically tonight at Mozart's death, it humanizes him. And it makes him somehow easier to deal with. It makes him approachable. It makes him almost friendly. And that, I think, is why we deal with these non-facts. We've taken them through a complete world of fiction, and we've ended up with something, I think, close to truth. Something that is so attractive to us that we're fascinated with this, and we can't put it down. That, I think, is why we are still asking who killed Mozart. And I would like to answer any questions now. I've promised to get you out of here in about 10 minutes so that everyone can get into the auditorium. But if you have any questions?
I have a question. What opportunities would Salieri have to actually poison Mozart? Because he was supposed to any drink? Food or
what? Well, in the Pushkin, it's a drink. He puts poison in a glass of wine. They saw one another quite a bit. They were both in Vienna, and I mean the ostensible reasons for the jealousy in the first instance, and most of this comes from Leopold's letters, from Mozart's father's letters, not from Mozart, but they talked about Salieri almost as though it was an Italian conspiracy to keep Mozart out of work, and so Mozart applied for a job shortly after he went to Vienna as the singing tutor for a princess. Salieri got the job. Salieri already had very important jobs in the imperial court as capomaster. I mean, he did a number of musical functions. And so he was, at the time, Mozart was a newcomer. Salieri was establishment and official establishment. He was a court conductor, a court composer. I mean, that was a big job. So the jealousy has that awful edge to it as well, that, you know, this was the man who was the senior person. It's also, though, got bizarre aspects. Salieri was Italian, but in most of the letters that other people are writing about, he's talked about as though he's a really Germanic composer and not part of the Italian school at all. But Leopold, Mozart, talks about an Italian cabal to keep Wolfgang out of a job. Salieri lived 60 years of his life in Vienna, basically working for the Habsburgs, and I don't think he was particularly Italian at the end of that at all. Anyway, it's that's why Mozart looked up to Salieri, actually, and there's a letter, it's only a couple weeks before Mozart actually died, where Mozart was in a carriage and picked Salieri up and took him to a performance of the Magic Flute. And he reports to his father, and Mozart loved taking people to the Magic Flute, by the way. It was like, hey, I did that. Yeah, it must have been amazing. But Mozart writes a letter to Leopold saying, hey, I picked up Salieri, took him to the Magic Flute, and after every number, after every musical, you know, after every possible chance that he had, Salieri was yelling, "Bravo, bravo." And he plainly liked the opera. And so they were chummy in that sort of a way. I don't know if in the movie, in Amadeus, Schaeffer actually has Salieri transcribing the Requiem. Like Mozart's confined to the bed, and he's telling him, right. And I mean, you know, this is, again, famously Mozart writing music was like falling out of bed to Mozart. He just... And it's all there, and almost never corrected. It was like perfect, right on the page. Salieri in the scene in the movie is sort of frantically trying to keep up with Mozart, who's dictating music to him, and Mozart's getting frustrated. Like, can't you write it? Come on, faster! It's like, so they. I don't know whether that happened. I don't know whether you know they were actually working together at the very end, but they certainly saw one another fairly frequently, and they were in the same circles in Vienna at the time. So. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the piece that inspired Salieri in the play. Lord knows. I mean, we have no evidence. That's a Peter Schaeffer invention. But in the play and then the movie, what drives Salieri crazy is that here is a piece of music that was meant to be background music. Like, this is meant to be played in the stately homes of Europe, while important rich people are eating or chatting or doing whatever they do. It's background noise. It's like elevator music. And in the movie, Salieri hears it and is like, it is the voice of God, which is what he says. And that is what drives him crazy. Mozart has taken a form that was meant to be nothing and turned it into the absolutely extraordinary, the sublime. And comment on it. I mean, I had the great pleasure yesterday of attending the rehearsal for the serenade, and I can tell you, I love going to rehearsals, musical rehearsals. It's something, it's a great privilege, because what you're watching is the music being put together by the conductor, and Maestro Zuckerman was there with the performers, and yeah, it's being put together, but it's also, from my perspective, being taken apart. You can understand or begin to understand how the dynamic of mixing and matching and melding and pulling different things from different sections and different voices and making that one piece of music as it's like, stop, let's discuss this, where are we going here, what do you want to do, who's going where? It's an amazing privilege to be able to witness that. The real privilege yesterday was watching Pinchas Zukerman, because it's a rehearsal, so he has a sort of high, almost like a bar chair there. And he gets up in the bar chair. He was dancing as well as conducting. I mean, when he's on the chair, his feet started to move. And then at near the end of the piece, and this was absolutely, truly wonderful, he actually got off the chair, and he was stomping. He's got the beat going, and he was dancing, like physically dancing on the stage, having a wonderful time. It'd be great if he did it tonight, but I don't think he will. and then, the clincher for me, the punchline for me. So I at that point was the only person sitting in the entire opera. I was like in the fifth row or sixth row in the center of the house, and it was great. After they'd finished, and there was a break before they started rehearsing the concerto, and he turned around, and I was the only one in the audience, and he said, "Wasn't that great?" And I smiled and I said, "Yeah, that was great. And it'll be just as great or even greater tonight, I'm sure." It's a magnificent piece of music. I mean, Schaeffer plainly knows a fair bit about music and about Mozart. To have been able to focus in on this one piece that would be so heavenly that it would inspire that devilish jealousy that was the theme that he dealt with in the play. Yeah, I think maybe we should get going. Enjoy the concert.
That's all for this edition of the NACOcast. Send us your comments and questions. You can reach us by sending an email to nacocast@gmail.com. We always look forward to hearing from you. Don't forget, you can subscribe to this and other NAC podcasts by visiting nacpodcasts.ca, where you'll find our past episodes, subscription links, and instructions on how to subscribe. You can also easily find this podcast as a free subscription in the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store. Just search on NACOcast. So until next time, this is Christopher Millard for the New Media team here at the National Arts Centre in Ottawa.